Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for February's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Head Theatre Nurse at the Queen Mother Hospital, Alison Young. Thank you, Alison. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you very much. Welcome to this lecture. It's a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of fracture repair, trying to get in as much information for you all as possible. More than happy to take some questions at the end if we have time, but I also have put my email address on there, so if anyone wants to give me a shout with anything else they're not sure of, I'm more than happy to answer. I find these webinar things quite strange, not having an audience to gauge whether what I'm saying is going in or not. So, and I can't use my hands too much, so here goes. So we're going to talk a little bit at the beginning about how a fracture happens, whether it's traumatic or pathological. We're going to go through why classification of fractures is important. We'll talk a little bit about principles of fracture repair and the goals that we're aiming for, and then we'll talk a little bit about implants and equipment. Often I think with nursing lectures, although part of them I understand won't necessarily be in your remit of making that final decision, I really think that as a nurse, if you understand why your vet is making that decision, how that fracture is going to be repaired, you can be far better prepared with equipment, implants, instrumentation, in from a theatre point of view, and then in a post-operative point of view, looking after those patients, understanding how and why they've chosen the method of fracture fixation that they have, definitely can help guide you into what you can and can't do with that patient in the immediate post-op period and then longer term. And I guess for a lot of the time, it's you nurses that will also be speaking to the owners about this and sort of confirming, helping them almost with what the vets told them to. So I think it's really important. I don't think we should just do things because that's what we're told to do. I really think we should have a full understanding of the whole process. My little rant of what I think and how I think nurses should be. So to start with, we're going to talk a little bit about traumatic fractures. This is probably what we would see most commonly in our practices. Usually can be described either as a direct or indirect. So direct is actually that physical blow, so the car hitting the animal and therefore causing a bone to break, a kick of a horse. I've put gunshots in there. Luckily in the UK, obviously that's something we don't see as often as maybe elsewhere in the world, but that can obviously happen. And then an indirect fracture, traumatic fracture, would be a bone that's been broken by sort of excessive bending almost. So if they twist as they fall, often you'll hear of the history being they were running along in a field and their foot dropped into, say, a rabbit hole or something like that, and they carried on running, and so it's sort of a bending, a break caused by excessive bending. Our pathological fractures, probably we don't see them as often as we do our traumatic fractures, thank goodness, but it's usually an abnormal part of that bone that's causing it to weak. So most commonly we would probably think of a osteosarcoma, so a bone tumor, but it could also be an osteomyelitis, so infection, or probably very much more rarely, but it can be seen, a leg or a bone that's not used, either because it's not used it becomes weaker, or a nutritional disorder causing an osteopenia. So I've got some pictures in here. Again, this is where it becomes a little bit more challenging on a webinar as opposed to a face-to-face lecture, but I'm hoping you can see here that this sort of mottled area around here indicates that there's something abnormal there. We may or may not know exactly what it is, and we can't be diagnostic completely with only a radiograph because obviously our eyes don't have ClinPath options. But we could think that here we've got some extra bone growth here, we've got mottling of the bone, it's not a nice normal. You can see on this one here we've got nice straight lines, nice uniform bone, but on this one here we've got sort of almost a bit moth-eaten. So we could kind of predict or think that that's indicative of a pathological disease, so potentially an osteosarcoma. Let me move my little green man back over here. So when we're talking about classification of fractures, this is very important. Obviously, a fracture can affect any bone of the body, so from mouth, head, jaws, all the way down to sort of probably more common long bones or pelvic fractures that we would maybe see on a daily basis. Another reason to classify them can definitely help guide the choices of repair options, so things become a little bit more standardized. And then if we're all talking in the same language by using correct anatomical terminology, then we can all actually understand what we're talking about. So if you've got two colleagues, whether a vet nurse or two vets in the same practice talking to each other, they can understand where the fracture is. And again, if we refer on, then everybody in the group can have an understanding of what's being spoken about, where that fracture is. So it is quite important, rather than just being a little bit picky. So this is where we have to go back to sort of our nursing college days and remember sort of a little bit about our anatomy, where in the bone, especially in long bones, where we would see fractures occurring, so that we can describe that. So whether it's the metaphysis, whether it's in a growth plate in the physis, in the diaphysis, we can describe exactly on that long bone where the fracture has occurred. So that's something to do a little bit of revision on, maybe. So when we talk about fractures, where they're often described as which way the fracture line's going, so the direction of the fracture line, how many fragments are there, whether there's displacement, and we'll go on to talk about all of these in the next few slides, and whether they are open or closed fractures. So when we're talking about the number of pieces, or often you find different terminology used, so you might hear of a simple fracture. Well, that's sort of only one fracture line, so often just two pieces. A comminuted fracture, so more than one, more than three or more fragments, so lots of bits that all need to be put back together potentially. An open fracture would have an overlying wound, whether that's a very tiny pinprick of a wound that you may struggle to see, or real loss of tissue over that area, real degloving injury. A green stick fracture is something that's usually more descriptive in human medicine. So although we can see this maybe more so in our young patients, so it's an incomplete fracture. So there is a small fissure line in that bone, so it is technically broken, but those fragments haven't separated. So often people will have fingers that have a green stick fracture, so they remain in position, and it's a more of a splinting technique for their repair. So something we may not see as much in our patients, but maybe more in the young animals. So when we're talking about the fracture line, again, can we go back and remember? So we have transverse, oblique, so sort of goes around the long bone, a spiral, so sort of going from all the way around in a spiral direction, and then a comminuted, so as we said, three or more fractures, so lots and lots of pieces. They're the ones that as they open and see the number of pieces and think, crikey, what do we do now? So when we talk about displacement, we mentioned that they can be quite displaced or not, and sometimes there's something somewhere in between. So just about, I don't know, hopefully you can see on here, is that there is a very small fracture line just across here, but you can see on this long bone that there's pretty much continuity of each edge of this long bone here, and so displacement is sort of pretty minimal, which will, when we come to talk about healing and repair, would be significant. On the other end of the scale, we can see sort of quite large amount of displacement, so the bone ends aren't anywhere near each other anymore, and you can end up with views of radiographs like this, where you've got sort of the ends of the bone nowhere near meeting. So when we talk about displacement, we can talk about impaction, and so that's where the ends of the fractures are driven into each other or towards each other, and again, hopefully you can see on this radiograph here, looks quite like a spiral fracture here. You can see sort of the spiral shape, but you can see that this end here should actually be about here, and this end here should be up here somewhere. So we've got these two ends of the bone that are sort of driven into each other, and that would be described as impaction. When we talk about a displaced fracture, we start having to use terminology of where the pieces are, which bits moved relevant to another piece. So if we were to talk about this fracture, and this is where webinars and being in classrooms are somewhat different, we can start talking about to describe how what this fracture is. So I guess to start with, this is where everyone breathes a sigh of relief that no one can be picked on, is that we could describe this is a right femur. So hopefully you've all got that one so far. If you look, and then again it's quite difficult to see, but it is actually a comminuted fracture. There are multiple little small fragments at either end of these bone edges. So we've said we're a right femur. So, and when we're talking about it, we were talking about the fact that it's in the mid-diaphysis of the long of this femur, of this long bone. So that's how we're going to describe where it is. When we talk about displacement, we talk about this this part of the distal part of the fracture in relation to the proximal part. So if we were to talk about this, we can see from this lateral view that we've got sort of caudal displacement of this distal part in comparison with this proximal part here. So when we talk about it here, we're going to say that we've got caudoproximal displacement of the distal fragment. So you can say, it's just a posh way basically of saying, that this part here has gone caudally in comparison with this distal part here. That makes sense. And then if we actually looked at really close up on images that we could zoom into, we could see that there's sort of several little fragments in there associated with that proximal end. Something else that you may or may not appreciate, and it's difficult again to tell on this sort of view, is that how swollen the soft tissue is. So you can see that this is the long bone, but you can see that this is sort of the edge of the soft tissue all the way over here. So we've got quite a severely swollen area. The soft tissue swelling has really is really swollen around that fracture site. So what I would hope you'd like to do maybe is that when you see some fracture radiographs, you can start describing how the fracture is and where it is, what limb it is to start with, where it is on the bone, what kind of fracture line there is, whether it's simple, comminuted, whether there's a spiral fracture there, and then a little bit about the description of its displacement. So caudal proximal, so it's moved backwards and up, so it's gone towards the body of that distal fragment. So it's a description of the distal fragment in respect to the proximal fragment. Sound like a professional by the end of it. So again, just going back to our college days and remembering sort of back to some bone biology. My cat's just decided to make an appearance and meow as loudly as he can. So we can say that bone is made of the two types that we would normally remember, so cortical bone and cancellous bone. And this is really important, the difference between the two, because again, that very much will depend on the method or the equipment, the implants that you're going to use for repair. So cortical bone, obviously being very dense and strong, it's found in the diaphysis of the long bone, so the long middle part of the long bone, and that's, you can understand, is the has a big surface area, so that's where you're probably going to find most fractures, sort of, especially from a bending point of view, most fractures would happen there. The cancellous bone is much softer, much less dense, much less tightly packed, and is at the ends of the bone, so the metaphysis and the epiphysis of the long bones, and that's significant when it comes to which implants we're going to use. So when it comes to choosing how fractures are going to be repaired, we need to think about the forces that are acting on them and what has to be overcome to allow them to heal. So it makes sense that we need to make sure that there's no motion at that fracture site, so it remains a sort of a rigid structure. And if we don't overcome these forces, then that fracture repair will fail. And again, hopefully these next few slides will make it a little bit more easy to understand, and sort of then you almost have that light bulb moment of, oh yeah, okay, I get it now. And that's why they've chosen what they want. So we need to understand how the forces work when the fracture is being planned on how we're going to repair it. So I'm not known for my artistic abilities, so excuse the diagrams, but we can think of that there's three different types of forces, the first being rotation. So we can think that the bone could twist around on each other. This is where I need my hands to show you as well. But we can understand, or can hopefully can imagine, that sort of we could have a rotation round of this end of the bone separate to this end of the bone. So if there's movement in the middle, twisting, and it's usually where the weight of the body changes direction while the animal's limb bearing. So you can imagine that this section is joined at the top of the limb, and this section is joined at the bottom, and because there's a fracture across the middle, they can move independently. So when the animal changes direction, this will twist one way and this can twist the other. So if we don't overcome that twisting, that rotation, then this fracture isn't going to heal, because we're going to constantly have movement at the fracture site, and then we won't have any callus formation and no repair. The second force would be compression. So especially if our patients are weight bearing on the limb, this downward compression through the long axis of the long bone can compress this area, and so we're going to have movement here, and again we're not going to have good fracture healing. We're going to have pushing downward, shortening of that bone, and this can happen also with muscle contraction. It doesn't necessarily have to be with downward force, but often if our patients will actually put weight down on that limb. So we need to keep both of these ends stable so that there is no sort of compression on this fractured area in the middle. And then bending. So the last force would be bending. So especially when a bone is at an angle to the ground, which if you think of the limbs, hind limbs, especially of a dog or a cat, that's definitely the case. They're not necessarily completely vertical. Or if a muscle pulls on one side more than the other, that we would have bending. So again, we think that our bones are fixed at the top and bottom within their normal structures, and then normally this would be a complete structure, but if we've got any kind of fracture line, then it's not going to be the case, and we're going to have potentially bending. So this one moving this way, this one moving this way, and then opening that fracture line in the middle. Oh dear. So those are the three forces we need to overcome when we come to fixing them. And when we start talking about methods of fracture repair shortly, then it will become a little clearer about what's used and why modifications are made. But we need to really think about what it is we're doing with this fracture fixation. What is our main goal? So really, our main aim is to make sure that this animal becomes functional again, and that we have functional anatomy of the bone. So we need to make sure that the bone, there's not steps, there's not uneven edges on each side of the bone, that we have a full length of the bone and it's a functional shape, so that animal can continue to run and jump and do all of its normal activities, and by maintaining these soft tissue functions, we maintain blood supply to that area, and we have a much healthier and usually quicker healing time, because we've got blood supply to that area, and we've not caused too much soft tissue damage in the process. Especially surgeons that do exclusively soft tissue or do exclusively orthopedics definitely have a preference about which one, or a priority almost, and so it is easy to remember that there's plenty of soft tissue around that fracture, and it's not necessarily just fixing the bone that's important, but to maintain the structures around. So we really want to see our dogs running around in the field and in the park, just like this dog here, just being their normal happy selves. So you've probably heard of ASIF and AO. So ASIF stands for the Association for the Study of Internal Fixation. The AO is the Swiss translation of ASIF. I shan't even attempt to give that to you today. And so how this group came about was a long time ago, and in human medicine and in Switzerland, where you could imagine that quite a few people broke quite a few bones while skiing. And there was no sort of standard guide about what should be done for each situation. So this group came together and created a sort of a list of guidelines or rules, however you want to see it. They created this manual of internal fixation techniques that recommend really all these important things that need to be thought about. And I'm sure many of you will have learnt these techniques through your nursing careers, and it's very much evident and prevalent in the veterinary medicine world that ASIF and using ASIF techniques is for fracture repair is definitely thought to be the how we should all be doing it. So we want reduction of fracture fragments, especially in articular fractures. That makes sense. We need to make sure we get all the bits back in the right place. Stable fixation that's suitable for the patient and their situation, making sure blood supply to those bone fragments are preserved, and as we said about soft tissue, so atraumatic reduction and good surgical technique. And really we want these patients to be pain-free, back to using their muscles and joints as soon as possible, because we don't want to go on and create them sort of fracture disease, which can happen if they're not using that limb. So fracture disease sort of encompasses things like muscle atrophy, limb disease, stiffness, potential osteoporosis and muscle contracture. And this little dog at the sort of, you can see a really, really straight hind limb, looks actually quite uncomfortable. And if they're not using that limb either prior to fracture fixation repair after the incident's happened, or even after you've repaired it, you want to get them using that leg. You want those muscles to work. Obviously, limited and restricted and planned as you want it to happen, but definitely they need to be using that limb. And that's why it's so important to make sure that the fracture repair itself is the best that it can be to allow them to do that comfortably. So that was probably sort of some of a bit more of the vetty bits behind it, and to work out why you're going to repair the fracture in the way you're going to do it. We're going to talk a little bit now about some pretty basic fixation techniques. I mean, this lecture could almost be a day of lectures if there were time, where you could go into much more detail of different techniques and different equipment and instruments. But we're just going to go through some of the basic ones to start with, and then you can go off and look further into it. So obviously there is an option that we could just use conservative management for these patients. It's sort of slightly limited on the cases that it can be used for, but it's definitely something we should think about. So whether that was with a Robert Jones dressing, potentially with a cast or a splint, but again, we're going to talk about these in sort of more detail in the next few slides. Internal fixation, so we would often think of intramedullary pins, potentially an interlocking nail, and probably the most common implants that we think of would be bone plates and screws. And then also we can think about external fixating, so external skeletal fixators, ESFs, that I'm sure you've all seen on various bones around the body on our patients. So it is possible and it's feasible to use sort of external coaptation, so a heavy dressing, a bandage, a Robert Jones. It is limited to cases that are suitable for them. It's not for every fracture. Often a young animal, so a skeletally immature animal, may potentially have this as an option more so than our older patients, because they tend to be pretty quick healing. There is a risk with every bandage that you place on that you get bandage related issues, and actually some of these can almost outweigh the severity of the initial fracture, so skin damage, skin loss, potential for skin grafts, things like that, if a bandage is not kept and looked after well. So that is something we definitely need to think about when we use this as an option. The fracture does have to be non-displaced, which kind of makes sense really. We're just going to hold it, secure it in position for the body to do its own magical thing and heal it for us. So if we've got fractures, so some of those radiographs that I showed you earlier where we've got massive displacement, I mean there's not a hope in anywhere that that's going to make it back into a normal bone shape and anatomical alignment for that long bone. It's just not going to work. So definitely non-displaced fractures. When we're talking about the forces, we can think that actually it only really does protect about against bending forces. There could still be twisting of the bones, because there's nothing holding the top and the bone in place, the top and the bottom of the bone in place, to stop them twisting. And there's also no compression relief there. They can still put their weight on to that limb and press down those fracture fragments. So again, something that has multiple fracture fragments, this would definitely not be suitable for. It's fairly limited in the animal itself of where it can be used, so distal limb fractures only. An ideal and the way we should be using these dressings would be to immobilize the joints above and below, and it's pretty much not impossible, but it's very, very difficult to immobilize a hip or a shoulder. So really it has to be anything below, so it would tend to be a lower limb bone. As we've mentioned, prone to slipping, and if they do slip, they then become this sort of weighted pendulum effect, which actually can put more pressure on the fracture than not having it at all, or just letting the animal run around without the bandage on. So we do definitely need to be ever so careful that we don't cause more trauma to that bone and to that fracture site than the patient had before. But for very young animals, non-displaced fractures, definitely something that is should be considered as an option. Splints and casts are slightly different, tend to, for immobilization, splints with aluminium or plastic, the gutter splints, cheap, quick, easy to apply. Not sure that that dog looks the most comfortable, and kind of reiterates the fact that we can't really immobilize a shoulder particularly well in our patients compared to, say, a human patient. But they're definitely there. They can be used if you need to. But usually Robert Jones dressing applied properly is adequate. Casts themselves are usually there to sort of maintain a limb and extension. So often after tendon repair, it would be a way of managing sort of that sort of fixed position until we've got some reasonable healing, or maybe a secondary support if you've used internal fixation surgery. However, probably not often used for our patients. Casts themselves really shouldn't probably be put on for the first sort of 24 to 48 hours or so, because you will get quite a considerable amount of soft tissue swelling post-operatively, and if you then put a cast on over the top, you can actually cause some sort of pressure necrosis from that area, because there's nowhere for that soft tissue to go to. So often it would be a Robert Jones or some kind of bandage to start with, and then potentially making a splint. But again, they tend to be for more specific surgical procedures post-operatively. Internal fixation, intramedullary pin, something you've probably all have in practice and see regularly. So whether that's a Steinmann pin, so a sharp point at either end of the pin, the arthrodesis or Kirschner K-wise that you see often with just the trocar point at one end, and an interlocking nail, if anybody's using those, is also a type of intramedullary pin, where the pin goes down the intramedullary cavity. As it sort of explains itself. Orthopedic wire, so cerclage wire, if you're going to use that, usually in combination with something else such as an intramedullary pin. As we said, bone screws and bone plates are probably our most common method of internal fixation, and there are various ways of placing screws and lots of different types of bone plates available that we'll briefly chat through a few. So Steinmann pins, very, very common for our cats and dogs, usually made from stainless steel with a trocar point. It's a completely straight pin. You can place these just with a hand chuck and a pin cutter, so you don't even need lots of fancy powered equipment. However, that does often make it easier to place. And there's different methods of placing them. So if your fracture is particularly needs sort of putting back together as such before you can then maybe go on and place a plate or do something else, then a Steinmann pin can be used to sort of get that bone conformation, that bone shape back together. So normograde or retrograde insertion, so either from the top of the bone through sort of the proximal part through the fracture site and then into the distal part of the bone, or actually placing it into the distal part of the bone first through the fracture site and then placing it sort of retrograde back up that proximal edge, so to or from the fracture site, if that helps with that fracture repair. As we've said, they're in the intramedullary cavity. They resist bending. You can understand that if you have a big piece of metal within the intramedullary cavity, there's no way that that bending force, that side-to-side force, can be effective on it. But you can imagine that there isn't sort of rotational stability, so that the bones could, in theory, still rotate slightly on that metal pin, so we don't have rotational force overcome just the bending. When we think about KYs, they really are just like tiny intramedullary pins. Often, if you have metatarsal fractures, they can place sort of one up each metatarsal or through each metatarsal bone and joint to make little external fixators or internal external fixators for our little toes. Often they will be placed with another method, so maybe a Steinmann pin that ties into an external fixator, maybe using, as we said before, a rod, so a Steinmann pin in the middle, and then once you've got the functional anatomy of that bone aligned, then placing a bone plate on it as well. So often, to overcome all of those forces, we have a combination of all. When choosing, and again, this may or it's probably not your decision, but just so you know why they're doing it. We want that pin to occupy around about 70% of the canal at its thinnest point. So when you're getting out equipment, we can sort of think what would be most suitable for that size patient. We obviously can't occupy the whole of the canal. We still need blood vessels and all the sort of anatomy of that bone to be able to function still. We need the biggest we can get in there for stability, but we don't want to a massive pin in there that's too big for that intramedullary cavity, because we can again cause problems with blood supply to that area. Screws themselves, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of different types of screws with different thread, different types of bone need different types of thread, and that's why there's so many out there. Again, if you use sort of human products as well, it sort of goes into a whole new world of items that are available. But we can broadly divide them into cortical and cancellous screws, tapping or self-tapping and non-self-tapping. And when we come to talk about the screws in a moment, we'll sort of see why that they're important when it comes to the equipment that we need. So when planning a fracture repair, from our guidelines, it's desirable to have a minimum of 6 gripping cortices above and below the fracture line. So depending if your fracture is nice in the middle of your long bone, then that's really handy, because it's really easy to get 3 screws above and 3 screws below, because each screw will go through 2 cortex or called 2 cortices, sort of either side of the bone. We get 3 screws that grip both. Once we start getting more distal or more proximal, that's when we tend to have a few more problems trying to fit in those screws in that bone plate. So the screws themselves, a cortical screw, we've said, is much is cortical bone is dense, thickly, tightly packed, much sort of harder bone, if you were to describe it as that. So we're going to use in a cortical screw something that has a fine thread pitch. So thread pitch is described as sort of the distance between the threads. So we're going to have, it's going to be much closer together, because it needs to be able to grip that bone, that hard cortical bone. We've said for cancellous bone, so at the end of the bone, the long bones, it's much sort of softer bone, it's much less densely packed, and so our screw thread, they tend to be further apart, but they also tend to be, the thread itself is deeper, so they sort of come out wider, so to speak, so that there's better grip almost. So cortical screws can be used in cortical bone, as it would suggest, but they could also be used in cancellous bone. However, it's not true conversely, so really cancellous screws really should only be used in cancellous bone, so in the sort of ends of the bones. And you'll also find that you can get cancellous screws that come in this half threaded or fully threaded. So half threaded, so the thread only comes up halfway to the screw, because this is just going to sit in the cancellous bone and we just want it to grip here, or fully threaded, and again depending on the fracture and the surgeon depends on which one you choose. So once we're placing a screw, we need to think about what instrumentation, and this is as nurses, if you're scrub nurses and you're involved with fracture repair, you can be probably the most helpful piece of equipment, so to speak, there, because if you can get through the mantra of drill, measure, tap screw, then that's the order that they're going to use things. So it can just be a conveyor belt of passing the next, passing the next. And that's really important, especially when you've got a fracture that's being has sort of like held together, getting those first few screws in position with the fracture still in correct and anatomical alignment is really, really challenging. So sort of being able to pass equipment and instruments sort of efficiently and in the right order definitely will help your veterinary surgeons and then therefore this patient. I've put tap plus or minus because, as we'll come on to speaking in a moment, not all screws require a tap before placement. I've put this up briefly. This is something you can find in lots of different instrument catalogues. We have these printed out and up on our wall in a theatre, up on the board, so that people don't have to remember. I mean, we have enough things to remember, but which size drill bit you require for which size screw. So if you're placing a 1.5 screw, then you drill with a 1.1 millimetre drill bit. For a 3.5 screw, then we drill with a 2.5 drill bit for a cortical screw, and then on the right-hand side, a cancellous screw. So it's just so that you know, again, you can be that efficient person, a efficient scrub nurse, so you can have that out ready when you know what size screw they're placing. But self-tapping versus non-self-tapping. The self-tapping screws now have sort of that tap inbuilt into each screw. So historically all screws were non-self-tapping, and so you could imagine that when you drill a hole with a drill bit, it's a circular, a conical hole, and then there's nothing for that screw to grip onto, and so you would tap with a tap instrument, which looks a bit like a drill bit, but with this one here. So it looks a bit like a drill bit, but it's got much wider thread on it so that you can cut into that bone. And with that, you would then screw that into the drill hole that you've made, and that then allows a thread to be cut, which your screw will then follow. With self-tapping screws, they have the cutting tip within the screw itself on this on the bottom section here. They have like a little triangular thread, so as the screw is screwed in, they cut the thread beforehand, so it's done for you. May have its disadvantages in that if you have to take it out, you could end up stripping that area and may need to place a bigger screw instead. But actually you'll find that pretty much at least all of the Synthes veterinary screws are now all self-tapping, and so they're sort of limited choice of whether you want tapping or self-tapping. Self-tapping. Locking screws, sort of a different type. So the screw thread, where traditional screws ended just here, now the thread of a locking screw goes all the way up and includes the head as well. And so these work in combination with a locking plate and sort of provide that real sort of rigid stability as the screw is locked into the plate, so they become like an internal external fixator because they can't move against one another. They are locked together. So then they're the most common types of screws available, and then we now just going to briefly talk about sort of how screws are placed. So a positional screw holds two pieces of fractured bone together without any kind of compression. So it does exactly that. It sort of holds it in position. And so this you can hopefully see on this radiograph here that we have an ileal fracture, and that we've just basically, it's not displaced, so we're just going to have one positional screw holding this in position, an SI luxation here, and then an ileal fracture here, so that we're going to, a bone plate is placed here, but in order to get this box of the pelvis stabilized, this has to be held in position, and so this is just literally holding the wing of the ileum through this joint here, so that we have a SI no longer luxating, and so it grips both the near and the far cortex of that bone, so here and on this side here. It grips here on both cortices of the wing of the ileum, and then here as well. a lag screw, so I guess it's a little bit like apprentices being sent for a long wait or a whatever, left-handed screwdriver. Can you actually buy a lag screw? No, is the answer. It's a complete method of placement, so it's a way that of placing your cortical screw. I've got some pictures in a moment which makes it hopefully make a bit more sense, but the thread only grips the fragment furthest from the screw. It has no interaction other than the head with the closest fragment, and the idea is then it's to compress the fracture line. So it may well be that in a comminuted fracture we have one or two lag screws placed to hold compress that fracture line back together, and then we may put on a bone or a bone plate on separately, or it could just be that we're using some as a primary method of fracture repair. So here we go, to try and explain how a lag screw is placed. So we drill a much wider hole, so 2.7 for example in this example, 2.7 millimeter drill bit to hole is drilled in the first fragment. Then a guide is placed so that we don't have any sort of interaction with that tissue now. And then the second part of the furthest away fragment is then drilled with a 2 millimeter hole. So this is obviously much smaller now than this one. Then we would, if we're going to tap, then tap this to a 2.7 to make it suitable for a 2.7 screw. And then the idea is, and then this is just measuring so that this one's just measuring so we know how the length of the screw that we need. This is tapping. And then this, so this section here, this is a 2.7 screw and this is a 2.7 tapped hole. So this thread here is engaging with this part of the bone with these, this is the fracture fragment, whereas this is a 2.7 screw and this is a 2.7 hole. So this screw is just sitting in that hole, but it's not engaging with any bone in there. And so the idea is that then when this is screwed down, the head on the far edge and this one pulls up against the head and compresses that fracture line because there's nothing going on in relation to the thread and the bone here. That's such a difficult thing to try and describe, especially I find without my hands and without being able to jump around a room. So I hope that makes sense. But it's really a very useful method of knowing how to place a screw. Washers themselves can be used. And I have a brother-in-law who's a carpenter, and he always gets a bit confused the fact that I understand what countersinks and washers and things like that for, and I would say it's just exactly the same as in a piece of wood as in a piece of bone. So just as you would do in a piece of wood, the washer sits underneath the head of the screw, and it just disperses that sort of pressure point over a bit of a larger area, so you tend to have less pulling into that bone. And because these tend to be in the softer cancellous type areas, that's where the bone's much less hard, and that could cause a problem. So a washer often can be used in that sort of situation, just as you would in a piece of wood. Bone plates themselves act as internal splints, so they are rigid immobilization of a fracture. There are different ways to place plates. So either placing them as a compression plate, a neutralization plate, and as a buttress, a bridging plate, and all of which I'm sure you've heard before. So we should talk about those. So bone plates themselves obviously require some degree of open reduction, and we've mentioned how disrupting blood supply to that area can really have an impact on fracture healing. So it has to be done with care, and you'll find nowadays there are more plates available and more techniques. So this MIPO, minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, where we're actually wanting to damage or soft tissue or interact with soft tissue as minimally as possible. So you can see sort of this is a fracture along this long bone here, but we've actually only got two sites here where we've got disturbance to the soft tissue and the muscular layer, and then the plate sort of almost placed in a minimally invasive way underneath. Again, a whole nother lecture. So different ways of placing a plate, a compression plate. We want that fracture to be compressed, so we want that bone to heal through primary bone healing. A neutralization plate, so we've on the second picture, hopefully you can see that we've actually already fixed the fracture with two lag screws here, as we mentioned before, and now we're just going to put a bone plate on, sort of as an extra one to neutralize any forces across that fracture. And so actually we have the bone and the plate pretty much sharing the load here, which is obviously good for fracture repair. And then finally, we have a bridging or a buttress plate, when basically this isn't ever going to all get put back together with any number of lag screws. It's really going to be sort of non-reconstructed. It's going to have to heal on its own. And so we place a plate down, and the forces are all carried through the plate and not through the bone, because we don't want any compression through this long bone. So the plate is holding above and below that fracture line in order to take the load during the time where this fracture is sort of repairing itself. So common plates that I'm sure you've seen and probably use would be a dynamic compression plate. Large oval holes come in a variety of sizes, for different screws, again developed by the ASIV group. This is their technique, and probably one of the most commonly used plates in small animal orthopedics. Again, a few more pictures here to try and describe how it's used. So the screw gets placed into one end of the hole if we're going to use it as a compression plate, and then as the screw's tightened, it forces the head towards the centre of the plate. So you've probably seen in your kits that you've got something, drill guides that look like this, one with a green end, one with a gold end. They might be slightly different colours, but that's their usual colours. The green end being neutral, so the hole is directly in the middle of the drill guide, whereas the gold one is the loaded one, so the pilot hole is drilled eccentrically from the plate, so away from the fracture line, and that allows the head to move. So initially you would place with the green end a completely straight down the middle screw into the bone through that plate. Then the second one, this is the compression, it's going to move forward. We want to push that fracture, this end of the bone, into that end to get that fracture line to close. So you'd use the loaded end of the drill guide, and as you can sort of see, it makes the hole not in the centre of the plate hole, and so when the screw's tightened, it sort of slips, this is back the other way, but it slips down and then into the middle, which pushes that piece of bone forwards. So a pretty clever invention. There's thought to be issues with some of the DCP plates, so a modified plate was designed as an improvement. You can sort of imagine that, actually, if we just go back to you can't see it from that side, a DCP, but this is basically a big lot of metal and then a big gap, and then quite a lot of metal and then a big gap, and then quite a lot of metal and then a big gap. And it was potentially thought that could be an issue if you have especially areas of a plate that haven't got a screw in, because they're right over a fracture site, that you would have a weakened section. So the DCP, the limited contact DCP, was sort of brought in. It's got these scalloped ends underneath, and that was to try and reduce the amount of metal here to make it slightly more equivalent to the amount of metal here, so there wasn't propensity for it to break along the bone plate, sort of from a weakness, from a stress riser. But it's use it in exactly the same way as a DCP. It was also thought that actually having a reduction of metal rubbing along the bone and the periosteum, again, would help to reduce damage to the blood supply to that bone, which is obviously something we've mentioned earlier as being important. The locking compression plate, probably more recently, but now definitely commonly used. You can place a normal bone screw, so a cortical screw, or a locking screw in there. The poles each have a thread cut into them, as well as their normal end. They have a threaded edge, and that, as we've said, matches the thread on the locking screw, and so it can be placed and then lock that screw into position in that plate. When it's locked, it, as I said, it engages into the plate, and it's a sort of an extra stability there. It's angular stability, a bit like an external fixator pin. You don't have to have as much contouring, again, so less trauma to the periosteum, less trauma of getting to that bone as you're trying to make that on a normal DCP sort of almost perfect to the conformation of the bone itself. Cuttable plates are really, really useful. They have round holes opposed to oval holes, so you cannot have any compression provided by them, but you can definitely use them, especially for your smaller patients. They're really great because they come in these sort of two sizes, so 1.5 and 2.0 or 2.0 and 2.7, so each will accept either size screw. So 1.5, 2.0 would accept either 1.5 screws or 2mm screws, so for small bones that's really useful to have that option. You want the biggest screw you can get in there, but obviously as you get to a more distal, more proximal end of a bone, if it becomes a bit smaller, we can have sort of some bigger screws further up and some smaller screws further down. To increase strength, they can actually be placed one on top of the other, and because they come in long lengths and you can cut them with pin cutters down to whichever size you want, they're quite useful to have on your shelf because they can, they're not sort of just for one specific patient. External fixators, again, devices used to fix fractures. This all sounds quite posh, but a series of pins placed perpendicular to the bone, linked to a supportive frame of clamps and connecting bars. So basically sort of this structure that's holding in position, pins holding the bones in position. And these are really good because they are capable of resisting all forces acting on the fracture. So the compression, the rotation and the bending that we spoke about earlier, obviously because they're rigid and they're fixed in position, a bit like bone plates, they will resist all forces. So if we think about when they potentially be used, would be a highly comminuted fracture, so something with so many bits that it's really not possible to fix all back together in an open fashion, an open fracture itself due to infection risks, and then some other sort of hard to reach areas or hard to fix areas, so mandibular fractures, toes, those sorts of things. So pins that penetrate both cortex of the bone, but they don't have to penetrate soft tissue on both sides of that limb. So if you look at this picture here, you can see that we have some pins that go all the way across and come out both sides of the soft tissue, but then we also have these sort of what sometimes are termed as half pins, where they go and they must go through both cortex of the bone, but they don't necessarily need to come out of this soft tissue side here. And again, I'm sure if you remember back at college, all the different type 1s, A's and B's, and all the different types of whether they're unilateral, biplanar, or all of those sorts of options for external fixators when we come to classifying them. These pins can be placed that they can be smooth or they can be threaded, whether the thread is at the end or in the middle of the pin. There are some guidelines of which ones to use, and we'll talk about why in a slide or so's time. They do have some advantages. They have a less rigid stabilization, which means you get sort of the body doing its stuff a little bit more, so a little bit more healing by callus formation, which can help a slightly quicker healing process. But again, often they need a lot less tissue damage or movement, and so that obviously plays a big role in it as compared to an open repaired fracture. You can kind of put them, you can play around with them a little bit more in that you can have them kind of some quite funky, unique designs about where you are able to place pins. You're less sort of restricted maybe than you would be with a bone plate. Something that is quite useful is that they can be staged down during the healing process. So, for example, you have connecting bars on both sides and a fair number of pins, you can say maybe take one connecting bar off or start removing pins gradually rather than it being an all or nothing process. Obviously with bone plates, they're fixed and they tend to stay there for good unless there's a real issue with that plate. So again, that's a good and a bad thing. It means that sort of the bone can take on a bit more strength and function sort of as a gradual process. And I'll show you a case example of why they're quite useful for managing cases with wounds, because you can sort of do both at the same time. So smooth pins for can be used, and some people use them. The thought is that they may be more risk of loosening, because obviously there's nothing to grip onto that bone surface. And so if people using them, often they tend to place them at an angle 60 to 70 degrees to try and reduce that risk of pulling out. I guess I've put this in because K-wires may be used for some maybe smaller areas or sort of harder to pin areas, depending on what threaded pins you have available. So you can imagine that threaded pins, whether they're a negative profile or a positive profile pin, they have a thread cut into them. So negative being that the thread is cut into the shaft of the pin, whereas a positive pin, so the thread is greater than the profile of the pin. So this would be, say, a 2 millimetre, whereas the shank of the pin would be, say, a 1.6 millimetre. So that's just something to think about when getting equipment out. The clamps that go on the outside, there are different systems available, whether you have a KE system or the IMEX SK system, and very helpfully they like to call them all different things. So the mini in the IMEX system is a small in the KE system, and then the small in the IMEX is the large in the KE. Just when you think you finally got your head around something, it all changes. And it's these clamps that are joining the pins to the connecting bars. And then you can see at the top there in that picture, some are single clamp, so just one clamp, and then some are doubles. And so we could join two connecting bars here if we need to for our design of our fixator. This little cat here has a mandibular fracture, and so has pins going into that fracture, but instead of using connecting bars and clamps, which would be quite cumbersome and uncomfortable for her, this is an epoxy putty, or sometimes acrylic, that we can use to hold all those, almost like a connecting bar and clamps, but hold all those pins together in place whilst the fracture repairs itself. This is where your Mission Impossible style comes in, because it comes as a sort of a putty where you mix two bits together, and it's that reaction that then would cause it to go hard. The only downside to this is that once it's hardened, it's not coming off. So if you need to remove it, it does mean cutting the pins. So you have to be absolutely sure. So ours will go out for post-op radiographs with their pins in place but without their putty, to make sure that the surgeons are happy with the repair, and then the putty will be placed on when they're happy. Rather than with the clamps, you have a little bit more play in it, you can take them on and off a little bit easier. But the patients really tolerate these well, these little bumper bars, and they're relatively lightweight for them, so they can continue to eat and drink and be normal animals. So connecting bars made from different materials, depending again on your system that you're using. Carbon fibre can be really useful because they are much lighter for our patients, and when they have post-op radiographs taken, you can see through it. There's not just a load of metal. Complications with external fixators, things like pin loosening, bending or breaking of pins, potentially soft tissue damage, and this is something to think about when the clamps are being applied in the immediate sort of end of surgery time, making sure that they're far enough away from the skin, because it's amazing how much the skin will swell postoperatively and potentially cut into that clamp if you don't have it far enough away. Then there is also the risk of iatrogenic fracturing. So if a pin is too large, or if there's a fissure that maybe hasn't been seen on pre-op films, and just by placing a pin in that area, we get further fracturing. So with those complications, loose pins, so often caused by or cause discharge from a potential local infection, maybe they're not using the limb well, and the only real treatment for that would be to take out those loose pins, re-radiograph, and place some new pins in good bone. And I guess that's a risk, is that if you've already drilled in there, potentially we're losing bone stock there by having multiple holes. We mentioned briefly that it's really useful for wounds. You can still fix your fracture and treat your patient's wounds at the same time, which means you don't have to wait for one to finish before the other can start. So external fixators for wound patients are very useful. And you can see we can have relatively good healing and good skin reconstruction around a fracture site too. How quickly they heal. Clinical union is described as that they have enough strength to remove that fixation should you do so, whether that if that's an external fixator, but probably not if it's a bone fixation, a bone plate. And it's usually around 12 to 16 weeks in adult dogs and cats if there are no complications, but that will continue to remodel for sort of months or years to come. And we'd always have our patients back at say 6 weeks, 8 weeks check, sooner if they're younger, using radiography to assess whether we have clinical union. This is something we can think about when we're advising our clients about how long will this process go on for and what's the involvement postoperatively. Things that change wound heal or rate of healing, and that's something again to talk to our owners about. If you know your patient is skeletally immature, then obviously it will be a lot quicker for them. However, if we have any kind of osteomyelitis, or our patient has other systemic illness, whether that's a nutritional illness, whether it's on long-term steroids, any of those sorts of diseases, diabetes, all of those sorts of long-term systemic illnesses, then that will affect the rate of healing. And that's something that, again, they can be advised of at the beginning so that they have realistic expectations that can be managed well. So if we have a fracture that's covered with a large muscle mass, so lots of good blood supply, so areas such as the scapula and the pelvis, we'll have sort of an increased rate of healing, maybe more than, say, a radius and ulna, an area that has limited blood supply through muscle mass. Fractures in cancellous bone heal quicker than cortical bone, so fractures at the end of your bone compared to the middle of your bone will heal quicker. We said about the blood supply, and it's sort of less dense, less hard bone. Oblique fractures heal quicker than transverse fractures. There's a larger surface area so that we get good tissue regrowth. Again, this is all so that you know sort of how what to expect. If we have poor reduction or fixation, so whether it was the surgical technique that was wrong or it was a wrong choice of repair, that will obviously affect the rate of healing and it can prolong healing for that patient. So not bad, a bit of a whistle stop tour, but I do really feel that if you understand how a fracture is repaired, you really can look after that patient better in the postoperative period and to go on and advise your clients of the outcome for their patient. And this has often become sort of the nurse's role, and they want to ask you this question about how long is it going to be and what's it really going to be like to manage that patient. If you've got a patient with an external skeletal fixator, it's much, much different to have them running around in your house at home than it would do to have a patient with an internal bone plate, because they tend to take out most of your furniture and your legs with an external fixator. So it's all of those sorts of things that you can help advise on. So I'm more than happy to take any questions, should anyone have any. Okay, so sort of how you would, I guess, sort of to summarise this question, how you would choose whether to choose an external fixator or internal fixation. We've briefly mentioned a few bits and pieces about wounds, and maybe an external fixator or an open fracture, for example, would be one that we probably wouldn't want to put a bone plate on unless it was a sort of a grade one, had only happened within the last couple of hours, because of the risk of infection for postoperatively care of that patient with a bone plate would be much higher. But I think probably the most important thing is it within the remit or the ability of the veterinary surgeon that's going to be doing the surgery. Just because it's the gold standard and it's the one that you should do, if they've never done it before, if it was my patient, I would much rather that they did something that they were comfortable with, knew how to do, and had the relevant equipment and experience to do it. So none of them would be right or wrong, particularly over another. It's just a lot of it would be down to your practice's ability to look after them pre and post operatively, and the equipment that you have for the surgery. If anyone has any other questions? I guess one thing that you can also do that can be really useful, if you, when we talked a little bit about displacement and impaction fractures, if you've seen that on your preoperative films, definitely hanging the limb whilst you're preparing it can really, really help your surgeon during that surgery and therefore reduce the time of surgery. So having a limb, like a tie on the end of the limb, and having it hanging on a drip stand, but really almost to the point of the patient being semi-lifted off the table by it, you get sort of real muscle contraction with a impacted fracture, and actually to stretch that muscle so that you can then get good reduction in surgery, sort of stretching that limb can really, really help. So you do have to monitor them quite carefully under your anaesthesia, because obviously it may be slightly uncomfortable. It depends what kind of pain management, if you can use an epidural for a hind limb, that sort of thing. But definitely sort of hanging their limb for a period of time during preparation can definitely help your surgeon during this procedure to get good alignment and sort of not have to overcome that muscle fatigue that has happened. Okay, well, thank you very much. As I said, if you've got any questions that you wanted to contact me, please feel free to contact me.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alison for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.